But anyway, some people go outside and come back in again afterwards. Some people just come for the meditation. Some people think that they've heard all my jokes before. Every now and again you do get a new one. I'll now prove that before I start the talk. I told a couple, I always test out the jokes first of all to make sure that they're okay. And that was the story. It's actually told to me by a vegan. He told me about the piece of tofu who crossed the road. Why did the piece of tofu cross the road? To prove it wasn't chicken. Okay, well, at least I got some noise, not gross. Anyway, let's try something else. Let's try talking about death. Why have we suddenly gone quiet and serious? Because sometimes it's in our culture that when we talk about such things, we think, oh my goodness, this is going to be, even have a word for it, morbid. But it just so happens this last week, as many people seem to have, actually probably thousands have died, but you know, in my life, that I did a funeral service, you know, on Tuesday for a young man who died. He was one of our senior members' son, passed away. And just the day after the funeral on Tuesday, Wednesday morning, an old, not that old, I shouldn't say that because it's about the same age as me, but I'm a bit older, but one of our regular members who was one of our committee members, Suzanne Keane, Susie, she passed away a couple of days ago. Talking to her partner Norm, husband Norm, I know it's her husband because I married them, so a very lovely couple. And anyway, she passed away, she died. And he never wanted to have any funeral service or any big deal, but no, I'm not going to let her get away with that. So she's going to have a little mention today. That's a photograph just next to me over there, just to remember her life. And just sometimes not only that, it was a friend who came on a retreat some time ago, concerned about something, and he committed suicide in Hong Kong, I think last week. And another, Ajahn Bhamali's uncle, passed away, it was expected. So many seems to be deaths are happening right now. It makes me start to wonder, who's going to be next? You don't have to be old to die. So that's one of the first little stories which I tell at funeral services. Now this is not going to be morbid, because when we have funerals or remember deaths and partings, it actually gives a meaning to life. It gives it a purpose. It makes some of all the little stuff which we run around doing, creating sort of factions and arguments and difficulties with one another, sometimes that it focuses us, you know, when these things happen. So one of those stories for a young person who passes away, I remember this from an old monk who told me this in Thailand, because sometimes in those ancient days in Thailand or Sri Lanka, you know, we're much closer to nature and what we say real life. Even over living in a monastery in a forest. We just finished a retreat over in that forest monastery in China Grove. And when people said, oh, how do we practice when we go back to the real world? I said, what do you mean the real world? You know, is Perth real world? How many people dye their hair? I don't dye my hair. How many people use gel? I don't use hair gel. In fact, because I'll be travelling on Wednesday, the last time but one when I went to Perth Airport, and you know, you'd have your bag. I didn't say bags, just bag one, bag, where is it? It's around the corner somewhere. That's all I travel with. And they asked me when they were going through the security check, through the x-ray, and he said, "Sir, have you got any hair gel in your bag?" And I thought, hair gel? Come on. But why do you wear hair gel? It's not real, is it? People use wigs, prosthetics, all sorts of stuff. And air-conditioned rooms, you know, artificial lighting. Is it really real? Now we even have artificial intelligence. Nothing is real. Fake news. You know, it's... What is that? Real world? You have to go back into nature to find the real world. So anyway, what about me going back into the real world? In the real world, we hide things. We don't call it death. We don't call it somebody died. They passed on. They went to the other side. They were reunited with their family. They were... No, they died. Why is it that we don't find meaning in death? Instead of a lot of people find a challenge, find grief in one of the most certain things we all have to face. And when people in the last few days, that when we were talking about the future of our Buddhist society, when they started talking about, "Ajahn Brahm, now have you got any succession plan yet? Who's going to take over after you passed away?" And I thought, "What? Are you trying to kill me or something? Do you know something I don't know? I'm not going to drink that water." You make fun of these things. But it's good, you know, to talk about this. But anyway, going back to that monk living in the jungle, you know, who was really close to nature. And one of the stories, it's the same monk, but I'm going to tell the second story first because I thought it was really cute and sweet. He was staying in the jungle, in the middle of, a long time ago, rainforest, and one evening he got a knock on the door. There's no one lives, within miles from here. Middle of the night, something knocked on his door, and he opened it. And what was outside was a monkey, a female carrying her baby, sort of in its arms. And he offered it to the monk. The monkey was dead. And the mother, grieving for her baby. You know, he'd seen the monk being very kind and peaceful, you know, never harming any animals in the forest, maybe sometimes leaving some extra fruit out for those animals. And the animal, even though they didn't really know, you know, this human being, just thought this human being had some sort of knowledge, some wisdom, some kindness, to actually to heal her little kid. And you know, the monk took the little baby. I could see the grief and the hope in the little monkey's eyes. And just, he held it for a little while. There's nothing he could do, it was already dead. I just looked, the only thing he can do is give some compassion, some kindness to the mother monkey and hand it back. And the mother monkey just went outside the door and disappeared into the night. I thought that was a very beautiful little anecdote, sad, cute, but how sometimes even death brings even people of different species together, looking after us. We all share that same loss, but also wonder at one of these important parts of our life. But the same monk told me that later on he was in a storm in the jungle, and during that huge storm many trees and branches came crashing down to the ground. And he was, legitimately concerned for his life, because these were very simple buildings. No sort of building license was needed. It wasn't so structurally secure in times of storm. It was just so simple, just bamboo and thatch, and leaves mostly. And then when the storm came, could just try and shelter from the rain, but the builder would offer no no barrier to any big twig or branch especially, or if a tree came crashing down to the ground. You could see the big storms which we have in all parts of the world. And many trees came crashing down to the ground. As you know in my talks, I always like to add a bit of drama. Crashing down! Oops, sometimes too much drama. Because now, when I was a young Buddhist, sometimes people give talks that were, you couldn't sort of challenge them on the sort of the Dhamma and the very, according to the Buddhist teaching, they sent me to sleep. So I always made a vow, if ever I give a talk, I'd always make it sort of exciting. Anyway, so many trees came crashing down onto the ground, but then he survived. And in the morning, when it was calm and clear, could see, he looked around the damage. And the damage, many trees had just missed his little hut. But what really took his attention was not the trees and the twigs, but the leaves. The leaves which had been torn off from the tree and lay dead on the forest floor. They were mostly old brown leaves. Leaves which have lived a full life, many years, maybe many years, at least many months, a long time on that tree. They form the majority of the dead leaves. Amongst those dead leaves are many yellow leaves, some green leaves, and even some few light green leaves. They're the fresh ones, which could have only been sprouted from the twigs the day before. There were only a few of those, but they were on the forest floor as well, dead. And up there on the tree, there you saw mostly green leaves, but there were still a few yellow leaves and one or two old brown leaves, curly old brown leaves, which were still hanging on after all those years, even when young green leaves had passed away. And the answer to that, the meaning of that, seeing real life in nature, was that when storms come through our community, when people get sick or die, they mostly take the old ones, the old brown leaves. They also take a few young ones as well. And there's nothing has gone wrong. That's a wonderful thing. We can't blame anybody. It's no one's fault. We can't rage against the elements or karma or God or whatever. We realize this is life. And the only thing we can do when we realize that this is just an essential part of the human condition called life is that we accept it, we embrace it, we learn how to live with it instead of challenging it and denying it. And from that, so much we can learn and grow and develop this world. When we realize just how short life can be, then we always think that, why don't we be more kind and caring towards one another? Still remember this one gentleman who was 100 years of age, and he was asked, like you'd expect to be asked, by the newspapers, 100 years of age, have you got any wise words of advice, to all those who are not that age yet, but are getting there? And he said, yes, today is my 100th birthday. If only I would have known I was going to live so long, I would have taken much better care of myself. All the stupidities and indiscretions of his youth, now you have to pay for, with interest. So that's one thing, we don't know how long we're going to last, but what we do know is that that life and death can have meaning. One of the problems with suffering in life, disappointment, you know, when things go wrong, divorces, sicknesses, losses, and of course death, we always ask, why? Why is this? Why is this happening? And the answer is, you do find a meaning in that. You know, that it really is a kick up the backside to know that we too can go at any time. You know, one of my scariest moments, this was a little bit different, but it shows you, noticed how we learn from things, from life. Just when one of my close friends at college got married, and after the wedding ceremony, just young men, I must have been about 20 at the time, oh, actually, yeah, 20, 21, we were just hanging around before, at the reception, and we had this stupid conversation, all these young men. Is it getting some feedback there? Is that echo? Okay. That must be the ghost. Anyway, we're having a stupid conversation. We said, who's going to be next to get married? You know, all eligible young men, bachelors, you know, good university degree, you know, strong, fit, handsome. Yeah, I was. And then we saw, one of us said, ah, that fellow over there, Jeff, he's going to be the next. And then, of course, we said, nah, no one's going to marry him. And then the next candidate, they pointed at me. Said, no, my lay name was Peter. He said, Peter, he'll be next. And then later we said, nah, no one will want to marry him. And then came the scariest moment of my life so far. There was this little girl, this young lady was standing right next to me. And she whispered in my ear, I would. Oh, I was terrified. Save me. Poor lady. But anyway, I made sure for the rest of the evening. I was a long way away. But anyway, but then we say, who's going to be the next to die? Any volunteers? No, but why is it that we're not afraid of that? Well, we are afraid of that, rather. And so sometimes we really miss out on what the meaning of life is. And just because we mention death, we doesn't have to be morbid about it. That was one of the great sayings which I picked up from the great American canine philosopher, Snoopy. Sometimes those comics are just very wise. And sometimes these little animals, they can say so much more wisdom than what you read in a philosophy book. So, you know, he was replying to that his best friend, what's his name again?
Charlie Brown.
He said, Charlie Brown had just said, you know, Snoopy, we all must die one day. Can you argue with that? Don't be so morbid, we must die one day. Yes, you can argue with that. How? It's true, one day, no, we must all die. But most days, we don't die. And I thought that's so interesting. Most days, you don't die. But one day, you do die. So, realizing that most days you don't die, you better make use of your time and not waste it. It's really important. So what are you going to do with today, tomorrow, the next day? You make it very valuable. What is valuable to do? And valuable, once we know even young people die, we don't know how long we've got. What we do is make the best use of what we have. And what is the best use of what we have? You know, sometimes we go to funeral services. That is where you hear honesty about what life is all about. In fact, I will never forget this fellow who wrote this article. He was about to die, only had a couple of weeks left, according to his doctors. So You know, there's something we call, you know this word these days, we call it thinking outside the box. So he wasn't in his box yet when he had his funeral. He had a funeral service 2 weeks before he died. And that, you know, that's thinking outside, that's a really wonderful thing to do, because he noticed when he went to other people's funeral services, they're always saying these wonderful words about him, how meaningful he was, how wonderful it was to have him as a friend, how loving, how inspirational he was, and you know, just how they learned so much from him, and just how loving and caring he was. What a great person he was. And he said, well, you know, most of the time I don't hear that. Well, most of, you know, in his life, when he's alive, and when he's dead, they say it, but he can't hear it then. So why not have your funeral service first? When everybody comes up and says these wonderful eulogies about you, and what a wonderful monk you were, and just how... So I think I want my funeral service before I die. Is that a good idea? And all coming off, coming up, and just saying lovely things about me, and just all these great anecdotes, and all the times I thought they were bad jokes, and then you really come up and say, well, actually they were. But when you actually celebrate a life, why do we have to celebrate a life only when it's dead? So we can learn something about what the meaning of life is. So what do you learn by attending funeral services? You find out, I've never ever heard at a funeral service about how wealthy a person was. At the funeral service, they never read out their last tax statement and their number of assets. They never read that at a funeral service. They never read, often they don't say how famous they were. Instead, they just say how loving they were, how kind, how generous, how forgiving. And the things which people remember about you are just not what the tax office is concerned about. When people put a CV out to get a job, what CV do you put in a CV? They don't mention that at all when it comes to a funeral. The real meaning of life is something totally different than the world respects and values. That's one of the reasons why we can learn so much from this. And I've seen so often, sometimes it's a shame that people can't see and hear what happens at your demise or your death. So often I've seen that families have been arguing for years, haven't even spoken to one another, haven't seen one another. They will come together at somebody's funeral service. And sometimes I've been there and I've told them, said, you know, it's about time, you know, it's the first time we've seen each other in years because of some bad thing which happens. Come on, let it go. Don't you carry that to your grave with you. You remember what is important to let go. And as part of that, to forgive. Because it doesn't matter if someone's cheated you or done some terrible things by you. That's the past. Now's the time to let go. Reconcile. And there's something about that which is also, you know, silly things is what we remember. Yeah, like not turning your mobile phone off during the talk. Forgive and let it go. I should have actually mentioned, I haven't mentioned so far this year, that when you are coming to a talk, if your mobile phone goes off during the meditation or during a talk, even the mobile phones, according to Buddhism, make bad karma. And it means that in their next incarnation, they get reborn as a parking meter, which is the lowest form of life for technology. And the next level up is the speed camera that's also down there. But anyway, taser gun, probably back down the same level. Anyway, when it gets to just the learning about the meaning of life and learning how to be kind and what's really, 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 really important, that's where you find out just what life is really about. So sometimes when we can get so inspired coming to such services, and of course, you know, my own father's death, I had some unfinished business. Have you ever got any unfinished business when someone passes away? My unfinished business was that I was a 16-year-old when he died, and as a young man, a teenager, you're always, you know, you're arguing with your father, you're trying to be independent, you're trying to be different, because it's just a psychology. You're growing up, you've been under the tutelage, under the power, under the influence of your father such a long time. And now you're trying to be independent. It doesn't matter what your father says, you're going to be different. It's like that story of, and this is an old psychology. Now, sometimes that a very good source of wisdom is in the Sufi classics called Nasruddin. And Nasruddin, this particular story, it's a Sufi Muslim, a beautiful story, that Nasruddin had his son working with him on the salt trade. So they would have a couple of donkeys, and they put bags of salt on either side of the donkey, and they would transport it from one place to another to sell it. But his young son, every time they were going across one of these narrow bridges, you know, without any rails, if the donkey was leaning to the left, the father, Nasruddin, would always tell his son, push the donkey to the left. And the son, being teenage male, would always do the opposite to what his father said. So he'd push it to the right. If the donkey was leaning to the right, push it to the left, son. Now push it to the right, son. And so he'd push it to the left, just to be contrary. And sometimes I remember doing that to my father. You know, just because he said it, no, I'm going to do something different. And eventually, one day they were crossing a bridge, the donkey was leaning to the right, and so the father, as always, said, push it further to the right, son. And this time, the son pushed it to the right, and the donkey fell in. So what did you do that for? You actually followed my instructions. What did you do that for? Father, didn't you realize that today is my 20th birthday? I'm not a teenager anymore. So doing the opposite is just an ancient tradition for young men who are just competing, you know, with their father. But anyway, on this particular occasion, I used to like Jimi Hendrix music. I like rock music. My father used to like Frank Sinatra. And so it was only in a small little apartment, so we'd play the same music at the same time. You know what, the one which dominated, the one which everyone heard, was not Frank Sinatra. Jimi Hendrix was much louder. My father let me do that. And afterwards I felt so guilty that I didn't say enough times how much I respected my dad, how much I loved him and cared for him. And even little things which he said, you know, the opening the door of your heart anecdote, you must all know that one. But other little times, just when he told me, and he said, son, if you ever need anything that you're even considering stealing it, taking it from someone or from a shop, he said, if you want something that bad, don't steal it. Just ask me whatever it is, I'll buy it for you. And he was poor. And I knew he meant that. You know, he would steal himself, or he'd beg and borrow or get some money somewhere. If I wanted it, it was more important that he went into debt than his son would have to steal. And that really sort of hit me, that not stealing was so important to him. My father would do whatever to stop me. And it was that commitment which he had to his children. So, but anyway, I felt so guilty afterwards. And I thought, how can I ever say sorry now he's dead? But wonderful thing was, you know, in our Buddhist tradition, that you can always say sorry, any time, even after a person is dead. How does that work? How it works is that you get a picture of him or something, quiet place when you're ready for it, close your eyes, and you start to imagine, think, visualize him, and say, Dad, whatever I've done by body, by speech, or by mind, intentional or unintentional, which has hurt you, sometimes just, you know, because I'm a young, stupid kid, or things I didn't do, which I meant to do, things I'm saying, just how much I respected and loved and cared for you, even though I never mentioned it. Please accept my forgiveness. I'm sorry, sincerely. And when he did that, just you felt just an emotional freedom, a letting go. And straight away you felt, I don't know if it was real or imaginary and just making it up, but it was very helpful to feel sort of almost like a presence of my dad and what he would say. And he would just smile and said, of course I forgive you. I know, I was a teenager myself, just growing up. It's par for the course. You're forgiven. And that worked. It meant so much. Maybe that was also helped when there was, just check these people aren't here, otherwise they may be embarrassed. There was a Cambodian man, one of the leaders of the Cambodian community here. And he, when they first arrived in Perth, we made a connection with them because first coming here, I went to Shenton Park. There's a whole heap of Khmer people. They didn't know where the heck they were in the world. They were simple farmers. And we just tried to talk with them, and nothing was working. They could recognize that we were Buddhist monks, Theravada Buddhist monks, but we couldn't communicate. And then we started doing our traditional Buddhist chanting. And I remember that moment this day. As soon as we started doing this traditional Buddhist chanting, they put their hands up and they started crying. Tears, all the people there. Because it was the first thing they come to Australia they could recognize. This wasn't, to many of them, it was like landing on a moon. They didn't know where the heck they were. The whole culture was just so different. And they saw Buddhist monks, yeah, but they're not really relating to us, so chanting. And that chant, that first chant, they were crying, and that was it. They had a link to this land. And that's very, very beautiful, but these were so poor people. And after a while, you get to know them, talk to them. And one of them, some of them could actually speak Thai because they'd been in the refugee camp in Aranyapadet for a long time. That's in the east of Thailand, close to the Cambodia border. And they invited me to like a house blessing, a dana they call it. They offer food and make merits, good karma. And right in the middle of our chanting, this man, he'd got a wife, he came with a wife, but he moved forward and he got out, you know, one of these old crumpled photographs, black and white photographs of his first wife. Because what had happened, you know, he was a simple fellow, he got married in Cambodia, and that, you know, like many people, those of you who've seen the Killing Fields movie, that, you know, he escaped from the Khmer Rouge through the jungles, you know, just many people never made it. He actually made it across the border into Thailand. Many people got blown up, sniped at, shot, killed. But once they get into the refugee camp, only then did she show the symptoms of malaria. Trekking through the jungles, she'd contracted malaria. And the best help from the doctors that she died. It just got so close to safety, so near to a life And she died at the very last. And he was in the refugee camp for three or four years, when eventually that he met another girl, got married. And then he came to Perth, set himself up, took a long time, hard work. Then he invited the monks in, and he's sitting next to his new wife, his living wife. He just stepped in front of her, got out the old photograph of his first wife, who got so close to dedicating all the merits to her. It was the first time he had the means to actually address his loss. Right in front of his new wife, took out the photograph and just cried his eyes out. Wept and wept and wept. Shared the merits. Good karma. Thank you so much for being my wife for those years. And then afterwards, he put the photograph away, sat next to his present wife, and carried on the ceremony. It was a very beautiful way of dealing with the death, expressing the love, the forgiveness, the asking forgiveness, just settling things so he could move on with his new wife. You can always do that. Any unfinished business you have, somebody dies overseas, sometimes it can't be there, and you can always do that. Just think of the person. Years and years ago, doesn't matter. Think of the person and just reconcile. Because that shows you just, the best obviously is to reconcile while you're still alive. Reconcile while they're still here. And that's such a beautiful thing. And of course we always know that, you know, one day it's going to happen to each one of us. Not every day, most days we're alive. So make use of those at that time. What's really important in your life? It's not being right. You know, it's being kind. And that's what people remember you for. And then after a while, that when the end does come, there's sometimes that I try not to mention the old stories, but the most meaningful story which, you know, really sort of hit me, and just I try and share this with so many people, is when a person does die, you don't have to have grief. There's a difference between grief and loss. Loss everyone has to have. We're not with people all the time. We do lose, we do move in different directions. But grief is something we add on to loss. And on this, I was in this northeast Thailand for 9 years. And all those years, our monastery was a cremation ground. And not only a cremation ground, but, you know, we'd cremate them ourselves there. You know, there was no sort of health and safety. And the villagers, these were our locals and our friends. We'd go on arms round in the village every day. They'd come for any ceremonies in the year. We knew them. And when a person did die, there was never any tears. Never saw anybody cry in those 9 years. Once there was about one tear, but you know, that was insignificant. And they weren't suppressing anything. It wasn't as if this was a tradition, thou shalt not cry. This was actually, there was no sort of grief there. It's almost like you see in like farms or indigenous communities, you know, not just, you know, in Australia but all over the world. Somehow or other they got so aware of death that it's not a shock to them. They almost understand this from the time someone is born. So that was one of the first things, because the people were so exposed to death, they did pass away. They could feel, see, touch. It wasn't embalmed. It was a real thing. I remember when one of our very close members, a former treasurer, when he died, I went to the funeral, and that's not wrong. And apparently the last time they had to shave off this and shave off that, I didn't recognize him. He'd been embalmed. But anyway, that was good old Ron. But anyway, this particular time, that when a person does die, that it doesn't need to be sad. They were at peace. It was something in between sadness and inspiration. That's why even just last Tuesday, it was inspiring, sad, a mixture of the two. When I mentioned that anecdote of my father's death, I never cried when my father died. Never cried since. That was 50 years ago. Oh no, this was at 16. How old am I now? Yeah, 52 years ago. 51 years ago or something. Anyway, he died at home. And when he died, sort of peaceful, inspired, there was something there about life which I found really important. I wanted to try and find out a way of encompassing. It wasn't sad, it wasn't happy, it was spiritual. But the way I came to understand that, to reconcile it to myself, was that when I went to concerts, went to listen to music, had some of the greatest experience of seeing these great bands and musicians. Sort of, was it Rolling Stones when I was 11, sneaking in when I shouldn't have been there, seeing one of the concerts of Rod Stewart, only six people turned up, a private concert by Rod, seeing the first performance of Led Zeppelin at the Marquee Club, seeing, I don't know if people like rock music, one of the last concerts of Jimi Hendrix. So much stuff I remember, seeing even not just rock music, seeing Deep Purple when they were just starting out, seeing jazz, Miles Davis. So many great performers I saw. But I always remember every of those performances. At the end of the performance, I would stand up, shout, clap, cheer for more. The encore. And they'd always play on a little bit longer. But after the encore was finished, I had to go home. And I knew that I would probably never hear that music again. The bands would split up, the music would change, the inspiration would go. But there I was, walking out, knowing I'd lost the future of such beautiful music. But I never focused on that. I never ever focused that the concert was ended. The only thing I ever knew was how wonderful it had been, how inspiring that music was, and how fortunate I was to have been there to listen to it. I went home happy, inspired. And that was the same thing which I felt at my father's funeral and every other funeral I've been to since, when it's someone I've known or got inspired by, someone I've loved and shared great portions of my life with. How lucky I was to have been with you, even for a short time, to have known you, to have been your friend, a fellow monk, a person we spent so much time with. It was inspirational, like the feeling at the end of a concert. Yeah, of course we'd like it to go on, but it can't. We're so grateful for the time we spent together. I'll never ever forget that. Never. And I haven't. All those times with my mum and my dad. And I just mentioned this to someone a few days ago. Having arguments in a marriage. Yeah, of course people have arguments in marriages. They're just so close together. But what happened was, when they did have a marriage, it's one of the benefits of being poor, that you were so close together. You couldn't escape. You didn't have my own room. They couldn't go to another part of the house. They couldn't go into the garden. There was no garden. So when they argued, we all heard it. But more importantly, when they made up, my mum and my dad made up in front of me, "I'm sorry." And they kissed and hugged. And you know, that's such a beautiful memory called reconciliation, when people actually said sorry. And they meant it. And I could see it. It may feel weird to you, but sometimes I look forward to those arguments. It was worth it to wait for that moment when they would hug and kiss and say sorry. That's what I remember. That's what I learned. So all those little things which you learn from the real life, people arguing together, not putting on faces or not trying to act parts, but you know, being who they are, you do get pissed off at each other every now and again. But you make up and you just say, no, there's something more important than that. Yeah, we do sort of have the suffering that somebody's dying, but such a wonderful journey we've had together. Thank you so much. I wouldn't have given that up for the world. It's like when people have cancers. First time I heard this from the Cancer Support Association, now it's called Solaris. But anyway, I couldn't believe it at first. They said, I wouldn't have given up that cancer for the world. I said, all that chemotherapy, all that surgery, all that radiation therapy, all that worry, and knowing whether you're going to live or you're going to die soon. Exactly, they said. You know, you had to have been there and gone through it to know what I mean by saying, I wouldn't have given that up for the world. Painful, but meaningful. It's where we find the meaning. You don't find the meaning of life from a fat, bald-headed monk like me. I only just point you in the direction, and you find that out for yourself. And all the amazing stuff of life, in the nature, people who pass away, and they always leave something. What they leave behind is the time you spent together. The wonderful, beautiful times. Thank you so much for being my father, for being my friend, for being my son, my daughter, for being someone I've shared even just a few moments with. Thank you so much. It wasn't a loss. It was a privilege to have known you. And by the way, I have no intentions of dying, so not next week anyway. So one day, but most days we live, one day we will die. But we have many more days we're going to be alive. So that's a little talk on the meaning and the beauty, the message when people pass away. Okay, thank you for listening. Any questions now? Sadhu. And that is partly dedicated to Suzanne Keane. Also, who else too? To Brian Mitra. And also to Vincent Wong in Hong Kong. And Gwendolyn's mum. And Sten Erik Clausen, that was Bamali's uncle. There you go. Okay, we've got here. From USA, what do you think of scientists trying to create artificial intelligence, body parts, happiness, genes, and trying to live forever? That's, you know, if scientists are supposed to be doing that, they haven't got, please excuse me, much intelligence at all. Did any of you ever see the movie, what's it called, Groundhog Day? He was living every day again and again and again, so he could perfect the day. That drove him crazy. He would do anything to commit suicide. So, to scientists trying to create happiness genes and trying to live forever, would you really want to live forever? One of the other movies which I saw, Groundhog Day, was I shouldn't really be watching it because I was a monk at the time, but people said it was dumber. It was meaning, and actually they were correct there. And the other movie which I watched while I was a monk was The Life of Brian. They said it was religious, a documentary. They got a lot of good stuff out of that. And apparently, because I saw in the news that, what was it, Eric Idle? He was awarded a doctorate from Adelaide University. You know, he was a fellow who, he wrote a lot of Life of Brian, especially the last part, Look on the Bright Side of Life. You know, the little song with everybody on the cross dancing. And that sort of sometimes sums up just the rebelliousness, when you start to question things and find some more meaning in it. And it has already a couple of times, that Life of Brian, Look on the Bright Side of Life, that has been played at funerals. At the very end, just when they've committed the casket, they start praying, Look on the Bright Side of Life. Now, I'm not allowed to sing, and that doesn't count as singing because it's terrible. But there was something of that. But would you really want to live forever? The other movie I was trying to allude to was, it was a Dracula movie, but an intelligent one, not just for the scaring people. It was called the Thinking Person's Dracula, where the Dracula vampire, his curse was that if he came out into the sun, that's the only way he could die. Otherwise, he will live forever, for eternity. And he was, after 500 years or 600 years, he'd been there, done that, experienced everything which a vampire could experience. And he was so bored. Nothing interested him anymore. If you've been everywhere and done everything, why would you want to live? It's only because he had this conflict between being scared to die, not knowing what would happen, and being so bored with life. And that was his conflict. So to live forever, you're not looking deeply enough, scientists. Would you want to live forever? How would you spend your days? What would you do? After a while, how many more books would you like to read? How many more times would you like to listen to Beethoven's Fifth by the Berlin Philharmonic? How many times would you like to visit the Grand Canyon? How many times would you like to see the miracles of someone's birth? After a while, you'd want to go. And that was this meaning of this vampire movie. Dracula, afraid to die, but bored with life. Literally been everywhere. And so he just stepped voluntarily out into the light and died. Trying to live forever, immortal, would be the most boring, most torture you could ever give on somebody. Eternity. It's not a blessing, it's a curse. What was the other? The two Middle Eastern curses which I was told. I don't know if these were true or not, but the first one I thought was funny. The second one was really deep. And the first the first Middle Eastern curse, if you really want to sort of insult somebody, make them feel uncomfortable, was translated obviously from the Arabic or whatever, may the fleas of 1,000 camels infest. Be quiet. it's funny. May the fleas of 1,000 camels infest your armpits. It's got sort of class to it. It's not an ordinary curse, like you'd hear in Parliament House. This adds a bit of class. May the fleas of 1,000 camels infest your armpits. But the even worse than that, number one curse was, may you get everything you want as soon as you want it. And I thought, wow, that's so deep. If you want something, you want a glass of water, straight away. You want the winning lottery ticket, straight away. You know, you want sort of the most beautiful food in the world, straight away. You want the best sex, straight away. Everything, straight away. May you get everything you want as soon as you want it. Imagine what that would be like. That's torture. Anyway, so try and live forever, that's silly. Happiness genes, no such things exist. You can improve your happiness, but happiness and suffering, suffering is just the space, the gap, the pause between two moments of happiness. You need suffering to have happiness. Otherwise, you may have a wonderful life, but you don't appreciate it anymore. You don't even feel it. So, suffering is just the space between two moments of happiness. Happiness is the space between two moments of suffering. You can't have continuous happiness. Even St. Augustine realized that. He said that in heaven, he was a great Christian theologian, he said that in heaven, 364 days of the year you live in heaven, have a wonderful time. One day every year you have to go to hell, spend that day in hell. Otherwise you wouldn't appreciate heaven. And, oh, that fellow was on the money. Anyway, from USA, I hate to think of your eventual death, but when it happens, how would you like to be celebrated and remembered? I would like to be celebrated and remembered by everyone coming up and telling me their favorite jokes, the one who's traumatized them the most. Which I don't know about you, your favorite jokes, but I would probably go for the carrot joke. Probably, what would you go for?
I'm still enjoying the camel and the arm.
But anyway, how many of you haven't heard the carrot and the carrot joke? You know the carrot joke? You haven't heard it? Well, let's do the other way. How many have heard the carrot joke before? That's very few of you. Okay, here it comes. There were two carrots walking down St. George's Terrace when there was one of these drunk drivers lost control of their car, mounted the pavement and hit one of those carrots. And the other carrot immediately got out his cell phone and called 000 to call the ambulance. And the ambulance, being in town, came within seconds. And it looked at that injured carrot, realized this was serious, this was dangerous, this was life-threatening. So they put the injured carrot in the back of the ambulance, and his friend, the other carrot, the healthy one, also went in the ambulance. As they drove to Royal Perth Hospital, straight into the emergency room, the triage nurse took one look at the injured carrot, serious. Not a moment to lose, so put straight into surgery, emergency surgery. And his friend, the other carrot, had to go in the waiting room. And any of you have ever been, I've been in that waiting room sometimes, being a monk, supporting people their family members are really close to death. Sometimes they die, sometimes they survive. It's really tense inside the waiting room of the ICU. And so, after a couple of hours in the waiting room of the ICU, surgeon came in, recognized, oh, you must be the injured carrot's friend. It's not often you get a carrot in the waiting room. He said, yes, that's me, yes, me. What's happened? He said, I've got some good news and some bad news for you. He said, what is it? He said, the good news is he's going to live. Oh, what a relief. It was touch and go for a while, but because of the great doctors we have, in our hospital system today, even though they're not really, really appreciated as much as they should be, they're great doctors, because of their skills, especially this Buddhist female doctor from Bangladesh, he's going to survive. But the bad news is, unfortunate news is, he's been very badly injured. And because of his injuries, Mr. Carrot is going to be a vegetable for the rest of his life. That is what I like to be remembered by at my funeral. Okay, last one. How do we deal with thoughts of our loved ones passing? Just the thought gives me so much pain. Hey, what do you mean so much pain? That is negativity. They're going to pass one day. So make the best use of the time together now. And learn how to forgive, learn how to love. It makes life more real, more vital, more here, when we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. So, your loved one's passing, It makes you appreciate them much more when you know they're not going to be here forever. It gives immediacy, vitality to life. And just the thought gives me so much pain. You're looking at just what's going to happen after they pass away. What's happening to them now? So, that's actually thoughts about loved ones passing. You can't stop thinking about that, but change the way you look at it. Wonderful life together, the concert, the fact that nothing will last forever, and you're being real about it. So make sure that you appreciate every moment. You haven't got time to be angry, to be upset. You only got time to forgive, to love, and to learn what love really means. Love is not attachment, having them around forever. Love is learning how to open the door of your heart to somebody. And the greatest act of love, which is a nice place to finish off now, I mentioned this at the funeral, the greatest act of love will be to let someone go. I love you so much. Go with my blessing. It's the greatest act of love. Seeing that many, many times. These are memories which will stay with me forever. What was it? Jenny and Steve in East Fremantle, North Fremantle, somewhere around there. He was such a fit young man. He was a whitewater rafter, having the time of his life. Beautiful wife, Jenny, still comes here every now and again. And he got cancer. And went to see him. You could see what he was like, so strong and fit. And now, you know what happens with cancer, just so wasted, like some person who's, been in a refugee camp or not a refugee camp so much as a concentration camp somewhere. And he was going, there's no way of prolonging his life, but he wasn't dying. Went there one day, the next day, he hadn't gone. And that's when, he had an insight. And I looked at Jenny. She was worried, caring for him so much. Jenny, have you given Steve permission to die yet? She was his partner, really close. She got it straight away. And in this little scene, which again is etched into my memory, she jumped on the bed and she held the love of her life, Steve, so gently in her arms, looked him in the eyes. Steve, it's all right. You can die. I will always love you. You can die. Don't try struggling so hard to keep alive for me. Go with my blessing, with my love. I let you go. That night he died. He was trying so hard to keep alive, using his willpower, because he didn't want to hurt the person he committed to and cared for and loved so much. It's the last thing in the world he wanted to do, to hurt her. And all he needed were those words, "You have my permission." That's an act of love, to let someone go. And that turned that whole episode into something memorable and beautiful, something which I was so privileged to be a part of, and being of great service to others afterwards, I also. So, when your loved ones passes, as they do, make it beautiful. The sunset over the Indian Ocean here in West Australia, some of the most beautiful golden evenings stretched along the skyline, blues and golds and oranges, sometimes in monastery up in the hills in Serpentine, you can see that. Sometimes on Jhana Grove on the retreats, people can watch that. It's beautiful evenings. Endings, the crescendos, when all the parts of a symphony, they all come together at the very end, and it's impressive. Sometimes the start of great pieces of music are not impressive, but the endings just leave you with a feeling of being complete. That's how to look at the death of your loved ones, not with pain, enjoying every moment now when it comes. Thank you. Now you have permission to go. And all of you in this room, it's 9:07, so you have permission to go to, many of you to go to the toilet because it's probably killing you. So thank you for listening. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good. Hope that's of use, because we all have to die one day. But most days, we don't.
Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sangam Namami.